Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and every Monday I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. We talk about why they became motivated to act on climate change, what they are doing to help, and their vision for the future. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. For episode 23, my guest is Brett Gant, member of the town council in Apex, North Carolina. By day, Brett works for the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, and by night, he teams with his fellow council members to help battle climate change. The council recently endorsed the Paris Climate Agreement and passed a resolution for 80% renewable energy by 2035 and 100% by 2050. Brett has a PhD in atmospheric science, but to mitigate climate change, he prefers emission reduction to atmospheric engineering. Patrick, tell us a little bit about what you think about atmospheric engineering.
Just something we know. It's getting pretty apparent, baby, that we need somewhere else to go. I'll build you a house in the clouds. It'll be our own creation.
God, that was awesome. Patrick Short is co-owner and general manager of CSZ Portland. Established in 1993 as a provider of improv-based training for customer service, leadership, equity and inclusion, and design thinking. Go to CSZPortland/training for more information. His pop music is available at shortboule.com. That's shortboule.com. He has a 4.76 kW solar system and uses time-based billing. Last month's net usage was zero. Atmospheric engineering is a potential fix for climate change involving injecting aerosols such as sulfate particles into the upper atmosphere to reflect sunlight back into space, keeping it from the Earth. Data from the Mount Pinatubo volcano eruption in 1991 shows a temporary cooling of the Earth by 1 degree Fahrenheit. Unfortunately, side effects from geoengineering are not well known, although one effect from volcanic eruptions is a significant reduction in crop yield due to a reduction in sunlight. Brett talked about how a career with the EPA, focusing on air quality, and being a member of the town council in Apex, where they can both reduce carbon and save money for the town in the long term, are more important to his generation than salary, and that millennials in general want to make a difference. James Henry Bedell, let's hear that Climate Champions jingle. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm sitting here talking to Brett Gant in Apex, North Carolina. He's a member of the Apex Town Council, and I'm really excited to talk to you.
It's my pleasure.
So with regards to climate change, after all, you're on the Climate Champions podcast. What's a memorable moment that caused you to do something about climate change?
So living in North Carolina all my life, I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina. And in the 1990s, when I was growing up as a kid, we had some major climate event, weather events that happened in the area. One being Hurricane Fran, 96, Hurricane Dennis and Floyd in 1999 that caused a lot of flooding in the eastern part of North Carolina. And that combined with seeing the news about the Chicago heat wave in 95, I actually remember that, how people died from a heat wave, and I was just surprised, and I couldn't believe that some heat wave could cause that much damage and that many deaths.
Yeah.
So the combination of the heat wave and the hurricanes really got my attention in terms of, is the climate changing?
How did you make the connection that it was climate related?
Well, I mean, you can't, obviously can't ascribe individual weather events to climate change, but I guess the sum total of those extreme events happening in a very short amount of time was enough for me to want to investigate it further. Once I went to high school and in college, I decided to major in that because I thought it was an interesting topic.
Ah, it's really exciting. Yeah. Yeah.
That was right when the IPCC reports were starting to come out, and I think the knowledge of climate change was becoming a problem, was becoming important nationally as well. But locally, those big storms, those heat waves on the news really had an impact on me.
You know, when it hits you locally, that's when you stand up and take notice. This is important.
Right. And growing up, I love snow, and the mountains of North Carolina used to have a lot of snow. Maybe not as much as, you know, up in New York, but for the state, it had a lot of snow. And in, I saw pictures of me in the 80s, basically halfway covered with snow. And by the time I got to high school, it was very rare. And I was kind of sad about that. And that's another thing, too, is with climate change, is that this weather changes, you know, I got out of school less because of that, too. So as a kid, that was kind of annoying. And so that's another reason I was looking into it as well, on a personal level.
There you go. So speaking of personal, what are other personal reasons that this is important to you?
We're living in an era that likely we won't see big snows, and we'll see more and more heat waves in the future. I'm kind of worried about myself as I get older. You know, I don't have kids, but if I did, them experiencing a climate that, and in the state in particular, North Carolina, with the sea level rise that may be happening and the heat waves and changes in the vegetation that may be happening, I think it's turning into a world that may be less appealing to my kids and grandkids if I have them. And having that, being the cause of that, being part of this society that's a cause of that, is really upsetting to me. And wanting to, that's why I've gotten involved in the field I have, is to making sure that I'm not personally responsible as much as possible for future impacts that future generations will have. You know, I don't think it's irresponsible to not do your part, I think, in terms of climate. If there are people like us that, you know, on the audience of your podcast and people like me that aren't doing anything now, we know we're kind of screwed up and doomed for the future. And so that's why I take it personally now, is we've heard news about a pretty small amount of time left to really make some drastic changes in terms of carbon emissions and all that. And we got to do it now. And I take that personally, because I think that the future, I don't want our kids and grandkids to live in a world that is not like we have right now.
And it could be a lot worse than what we have, right?
I mean, I've seen the projections of 1.5 degrees warming, 2 degrees, and I think the worst case scenarios are way higher. And even at the low level, it's pretty big impacts. And in North Carolina in particular, we have the Outer Banks, which are, you know, these sand islands, and they're extremely vulnerable to sea level rise. And we have a very low-lying coastal plain in North Carolina that, if there's sea level rise, we're gonna lose a lot of development. A lot of people are gonna be displaced, and so that's the low end of the spectrum. I think if it's the hot end, we're gonna be living in all these tropical diseases that may be happening in our area that right now we don't have that. A lot of things are dire in the future projections, and trying to avoid that, I think, is really important.
So that gets me right into the next question, which is, how do you explain to others that this is real and that this is important?
Okay, so I think everyone is kind of seeing things change right now. And unless they have their head in the sand, they're seeing kind of differences happening with the climate, with heat waves, and the winters are not as warm, the nights are warmer. But what I normally tell them is that, okay, well, when you drive a car around, it's emitting CO2, and that's going into the atmosphere. And that the concentrations of carbon dioxide are going up, and they can measure that very closely. And so that's undeniable, that CO2 is increasing, and methane too, but especially CO2, it's going up. You can measure it very accurately, and they do that in Hawaii on the mountaintops. And CO2 is a greenhouse gas that traps the radiation from
Earth.
It's
like turning the Earth into a greenhouse. And we know what happens in a greenhouse, right?
It's undeniable that the concentrations are going up in the atmosphere, that we're emitting more than the Earth can accommodate. And once you get to that point, and once you know that CO2 can absorb this radiation, what to do after that, I think, is sometimes where you can kind of fight about what the next cause of action is. But at least to that point, it's undeniable. And so that's why I try to tell them, they have measurements of this, that's the beginning. And then from then on out, whether you say we want to go a certain route with changing cars or changing power plants, all these things, that's a policy choice. But the science is right there at the very beginning. If you look at the tree rings and look at the ice cores and lake cores, all these things, it's undeniable that the concentrations before humans were involved with all this combustion were way lower than they are now. And so I start with the concentrations of the CO2 and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and go from there. And I try to explain that first.
I'll tell you, it's very interesting because you're one of the few people to mention that.
Okay.
Most people go into where you started, and that was with the big events that are happening, the hurricanes, the fires, the floods. And I'm a numbers person, so I really get off on the data that you're talking about. But most people are more moved by the fact that they can tell that things are definitely not like they were before.
Well,
weather-wise.
It's pretty emotional when you see big hurricanes go forward, or polar bears getting on those icebergs that are fading away. But yeah, I'm a numbers guy too. I have a PhD in atmospheric science, and that graph of the concentration that goes up, and has a little bit of a seasonality with the northern hemisphere having the trees growing in the fall when the trees lose their leaves. There's a little wiggle there, but it's an increasing chart. Time, it's pretty constantly increasing too, and so that part, it's undeniable.
And the fact that you just explained about the trees, when they grow, you get a down, and
right.
When they don't grow, you get an up, right?
It's very explainable.
Yeah. So tell me what you do on the town council.
So my day job first is I work for the EPA. In the North Carolina, there's all the air quality policy that the EPA does and it initiates here in North Carolina. And then the folks in Washington, administrators, are the ones who end up signing it. So a lot of the research, a lot of the policy happens here at EPA. So I work in the air pollution field with my day job. My nighttime job, I guess, is with the Apex Town Council. It's kind of unusual, I think, to have a scientist or a government employee on a town council. And actually, you're not allowed to be on any partisan office as a federal employee. But local offices like the Apex Town Council are allowed. And so it's been really interesting. I've been elected for about a year and a half now. And the town councils, at least in North Carolina, they do a lot with land use policy, transportation. We're doing some stuff with climate, which the land use and transportation play into climate as well. So I think the local level, you can have a big impact on climate as a municipal government, more than I think most people think. Most people, I believe, think it's on the federal level with the cap and trade or a Green New Deal, whatever this kind of high-level stuff is. But it's local land use, local transportation, local initiatives regarding renewable energy that can really have a big impact as well. And so that's my nighttime job right now. And they both kind of go well together, I feel like, in a way.
Yeah. So what are you most proud of that you've done on the council?
Our council has been, to give you a little context about Apex, we're a suburb of Raleigh. We're in North Carolina, which is a purple state. And Apex is a town of 55,000. But growing really quickly right now. It's won a lot of these awards for best place to live in the United States for a small town. So that's the context of our town. The politics of Apex have been, I would say, changing a bit. People from that are moving in, not from North Carolina, have a little different view of politics often than people that are native North Carolinians. And so we've had the opportunity in the last year to make some, I would say, some pretty substantial changes. Maybe the most climate relevant thing is that we've endorsed the Paris Climate Agreement. After the U.S. pulled out of that.
That's pretty bold.
It is. We actually followed a lot of the municipalities and counties in the area on that one, so we weren't necessarily the front runner in that, but it was a big step, I think. Also, we've made a resolution to go 100% renewable by 2050, which is a bit of ways out, but we're also doing 80% by 2035, so getting us there pretty quickly. And maybe what's more unusual for a municipality our size is that we've really invested in solar, both on town buildings. Basically, we've already approved about half of the town buildings, half of the town rooftops covered with solar.
That's very exciting.
And we're, in the next couple of years, we'll probably do every single rooftop covered in solar. In terms of residential, we've encouraged developers in our area to do solar installations on their own developments. We've composed letters that they give out to their new residents to say many homes are pre-wired for solar energy right now. And so the insulation cost of solar is a little bit less because you don't have to tear up the wall to put the wires in.
Right, right.
We've also reduced the inspections for solar energy units to zero to encourage more solar installations. You know, these are things that we're starting just now to be able to take advantage of. So I would say our amount of solar in town is still pretty low, but we hope to be, with these kind of policies, to be increasing it quite a bit going forward. We're also thinking about solar farms, because if we're going to try to meet this 2035 80% renewables, we have a long way to go. And covering the rooftops with solar is not necessarily going to do the trick. We got to have a little bigger scale. And so I'm hopeful that we'll partner with Wake County. It's the capital county of North Carolina. Partnering with them, partnering with some of the municipalities in the area to do a solar plant that's big enough so that it has economies of scale, but also that we get our fraction that can help us meet these kind of aggressive goals for renewable.
That's very exciting. It seems like trying to move that fast and that strong would bring about some challenges as well. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it definitely has. People, first of all, there's a newness to all this that people may say, well, whoa, what are you guys doing? This is too much too fast in terms of the solar. I disagree, because I think that the science would indicate we got to move fast on this topic. And so that really doesn't bother me. The other thing we get a lot is people say, oh, well, you know, the town has a finite amount of money. You can't raise taxes through the roof, or people will rebel. And so they'll say, well, you should spend the money on parks or on roads or police or fire or whatever.
They all sound really important.
Yes, and they are. And they are important. And so it's been a challenge to say, we're going to invest. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We're going to invest in those important things, town services that are required for a town to be safe and the people to feel secure there. But also, we're going to invest in these other things like the solar on the rooftops. And frankly, doing things like sidewalks, bike lanes. We just passed a bike master plan in the last year that we're hopeful will help guide development and investment from the town to other modes of transportation besides cars. I think the things that people are used to with sidewalks and roads can also be, if with some thoughtful planning, could be helpful for the abating climate change emissions as well.
On my rooftop, I have 8 kW of solar.
Okay, wonderful.
And yes, it was a capital investment. I put the money up front. I could have also gotten a loan. If I had gotten a loan, the savings on my energy bill would have been more than the loan amount, so I would have made money. Mm-hmm. I could have leased, and if I leased, the same thing, I would have made money. But putting it and paying the capital investment, what it did is every year I save money that I can spend on bike lanes. No, I don't need bike lanes in front of my house. I have other things I need. But I'm saving money every year, and it was a 5-year payback. I mean, you're 6 soon, so I'll be in the money, uh-huh, you know, going forward forever. So isn't the town like that? Aren't you going to make your money back, in essence?
So, yes, and the payback, I've heard, is between 7 and 10 years. We don't get the tax credits as a municipality that private people...
That's what puts it up, yeah.
Yeah, so, but we have a system, I think, where we're leasing it from a company. They're getting the tax credits for the installation, and we're buying the energy from them for the first little bit, and then once that's all paid off in 7 to 10 years, then we own the solar panels.
You see, that's an example of leveraging the tax equity
right
formula, some of which Jiggershaw put into play.
Right, right. He's a smart man. When I'm trying to sell the solar to people, I say, well, it's good for the environment. That's kind of the easy first thing to say. And most people say, in town, especially the people that are moving in from different places, they say, that's great. We want that. We want Apex to be more green as a community. But the payback being in 7 to 10 years, the lifetime is at least 30 years for these solar panels. It's like, yeah, okay, it's going to make money. It's going to be way better investment than just putting your money in a bank somewhere, getting a very low interest rate. And I haven't used that argument about building more sidewalks with the savings. We could say we're a purple town as far as politics go. You could say we can charge less taxes maybe in the future if we're paying less for electricity. And so having that payback for me was an easy one to say, okay, it's worth doing. And towns, by the way, can do bonds. They can borrow the money. We're a AAA rated municipality, so we can borrow money for very, very cheap.
Seems like a no-brainer.
Right.
Borrow the cheap money, save more money on the electricity every year.
Exactly, exactly. And so that's why we're investing in these solar panels right now. And I believe in our last budget year, we spent, they came to about $500,000, maybe $550,000. And that was going to cover a majority of our rooftops in town. And so that money, you know, it's an investment up front. And the solar farms, if we do that, that'll be investment up front with the, probably very low rates. But the payoff being so fast, and I think maybe 10 years is probably the longest it can be. And I think residential solar can be even less than that when they get the tax credits. I think future councils will thank us for doing this because we'll free up some money that we're meeting our these climate goals. We're freeing up money on power costs to put somewhere else.
And you cleaned up the town.
That's right.
Like
that's
an old-time sheriff.
That's right.
Different kind of cleanup. So you talked a little bit about Hurricane Fran and Hurricane Floyd.
Right.
And that inspiring you ultimately to study it as a profession. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. So after those weather events, let me also mention in terms of air quality, if you guys ever get the chance to visit Western North Carolina, there's the Blue Ridge Parkway, which I think is the, if it counts as a park, it's the most visited national park in the country. And the Smoky Mountain National Park is also one of the most visited places in the country. When I was growing up, my dad would take me up on the parkway pretty often, maybe once a week. We go up to Mount Mitchell, which is the highest mountain in North Carolina. All the trees were dying up there because of acid rain. In the summertime also, the views of the mountains from the vistas of the parkway were terrible. You couldn't see anything. The weather, hurricanes, and extreme events that were happening in North Carolina combined with acid rain destruction on the mountains and the poor views, that was all that together made me want to get into environmental science in general. I majored in environmental science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And during that time was when Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, came out. The IPCC report came out. He won the Nobel Prize. All that stuff happened when I was in college. So it was a really exciting time to be in the field. But I decided I want to go more into the quantitative realm. And so I went to grad school at North Carolina State University to study atmospheric science. And so I have a PhD from there. It was 5 long, hard years to get that PhD. I'm not sure.
Serious science,
maybe
man.
Some of your audience has it. Yeah, trying to get publications and a dissertation and classes, all that stuff is really difficult. My dissertation was about aerosol particles from the ocean, especially how plankton affect particles from the ocean, gases and particles, and how that affects clouds, which then affects radiation, which then affects climate. It was a pretty specialized degree, but it was really interesting. It was about as sciencey and nerdy as you can get, which is fine with me. In studying that, you learn that if you make a perturbation, if you change the emissions over the ocean, which cover 70% of the Earth, you can have an impact on clouds. And if you're covering a good bit of the Earth, you can affect the radiation from the ocean quite a bit. And so I learned all about geoengineering at the same time, because some of the ideas that they have about geoengineering were about
putting particles up into the atmosphere to reflect the sun,
both like sulfate way into the a volcano does, but also like waves do, sea spray. So that was really fascinating. I'm not a proponent of geoengineering. I think tackling climate change via reducing emissions is the way to go. But it was definitely a really interesting time to be studying this topic. And if your audience knows that the IPCC report, there's all these error bars about how much CO2 is warming and how much particles are cooling the atmosphere. The biggest uncertainties are actually in the climate system are actually in those particle impacts. And so tackling the place with the biggest error bars was also very exciting. And then what that led into was a job at the EPA. I'm a statistician studying particle pollution trends, particulate matter, especially there's a thing called PM2.5, which is the particles that are the fine sized particles that can get into your lungs. And so my job is to look at how those have changed over time with changes in mostly power plant emission reductions have actually had a great impact on air quality in the U.S., especially in the eastern part of the U.S. In the back of my mind, I always think about how, when a coal plant closes down, for example, typically it's the dirty burning ones that are closing down because they're the oldest. So they're having a great impact improving air quality in the area and downwind of the area. But also they're reducing the CO2 emissions quite a bit too, because coal's the dirtiest burning fuel. And so my job at EPA, even though it's more of a technical statistician type view, it's nice to be in the field where you're having a positive impact both on climate and air quality.
That's excellent.
I love my job.
It's great to wake up in the morning knowing that you're doing good.
Yes. I think a lot of jobs, so I'm a millennial, I'm 34, and I think a lot of people my age would take a job that maybe is bureaucratic like the EPA is, because not because of the money or because of the benefits, but because you're having that impact on a bigger scale. And teachers have the same thing. Doctors have the same thing. When you're working with people on an individual level, that's also very appealing. But it's also, for me, it's appealing to work on a thing that people are going to be breathing cleaner air and hopefully having less climate impacts Depending on the policies of EPA, that may or may not be the case. But at least with air quality, working to improve air quality, it's a market that has a lot of externalities. It's really easy to burn something and then have it blow downwind. You're not affected by it, but people downwind are. And so it's very, very appealing to have that, be in that field where it's, you feel like you're doing good, at least your small little way doing good for the earth.
Can you talk about your vision for the future? 20, 30, 40 years down the line, how do you see this playing out?
I'll take that from a municipal government point of view. I thought a lot about this. We do things like fire and police, so those probably won't change very much. But things like roads, we do that. And so we build some of the roads, and the state builds some of the roads as well. So it's kind of a mishmash of governments that are involved. But when you're building a road, you got to think about the bike lanes and sidewalks, because to make them multimodal is really important. I think for the future, as bikes and scooters and whatever else comes in the future, will be important. But we have things like, do we build a parking garage in our downtown? That's one of the issues that's happening right now. And from a municipal point of view, technology is changing really fast. And if there's electric cars, or in particular self-driving cars, that may make the investment in a parking garage not worth it. And so trying to have a vision of the future that is both climate relevant as well as how technology will be changing in the future is really tricky. Another big issue is land use. Municipalities, their bread and butter is looking at land use changes. And so right now in Apex, we're dealing with very fast growth. The schools are getting more crowded. The roads are getting more crowded. People are fighting some of the higher density developments in town. Or they're not fighting it, but they're questioning whether we need high density. They're maybe saying, oh, we should have more single family further out from the downtown core. And from a climate point of view, that's terrible to do that. It takes a lot to heat up the homes compared to like a more multi-story building. You're cutting down trees oftentimes when you're building new developments instead of infill. Trying to get the land use that matches the demand for housing that we have here in a lot of fast-growing cities like Apex, with a vision of the world that where climate change is being addressed, one way being more density. And so trying to do development now, not knowing exactly what the future is going to hold, but knowing it's going to be more self-driving cars, it's going to probably be higher density needed, is really a tricky thing. But trying to balance the current political climate, the current outcry from our citizens to have less density and spend money on more roads, they don't care. I think the bike lanes and the sidewalks are important to some people, but not to everybody. If you don't use the sidewalks and bike lanes, you're probably not going to care about those. Making sure our city is resilient, has the appropriate density, has appropriate walkability. That's a big issue, I think, that hits both on climate and appropriate land use and smart land use.
When you say resiliency, a lot of people in my field, when they say resiliency, means the ability to survive a power outage and still have power. But I think you mean that regardless of the future, that you can adapt to it.
Yes. So things like bike lanes and multi-use paths, these kind of things, I think are smart investments to do now, because I think you're always going to be walking around. You're always going to at least have your feet to walk around in. So even with a changing landscape of car usage, I suspect people will not have cars in their driveways. It'll be in some lot, and the car will drive itself to your house and then drive it to the downtown Apex, and you can go have dinner, and you can call the car up again. It'll come pick you up, and it'll take you home, and there's no ownership of the car. I think is my view of maybe 10 or 20 years from now. You're always going to need bike lanes. You're always going to need sidewalks to walk around it, and so I want to invest in those things now, because I'm sure those will be important. The things like a parking garage, I'm not as sure about. But it's a risk either way to like the parking garage, when people need parking and businesses aren't coming to downtown because they're concerned about the amount of parking, that's an issue right now to try to deal with. So resiliency maybe is adaptability, both climate, both transportation changes and technology, and all those things. Power outages, I'm pretty sure Apex actually runs our own power system. We buy power from Duke Energy, which is the local energy provider in the area. And we service all the lines, and we have linemen out there that do all that. And so that part, it's a pretty resilient power grid compared to maybe some areas of the country. But resiliency in terms of these other things is what I'm talking about.
It's interesting you talked about specific generations caring about walkability. My wife and I, we're in our 50s, but we love walking around. We want to be able to walk around where we live, mm-hmm. and go to restaurants and just enjoy the culture of the feel of where we live. So I don't think it's just young people. I think it's a desire that we have in us. You want to enjoy your surroundings.
Definitely. It's not a young person only thing. I think you're right. Maybe the middle age range, the Gen X, I guess we're going to label them, probably cares about it the least of anybody, but they still care about those things. But millennials and retirees, they love walkability, I think, even more than the average person does. And so, but I think everybody is getting tired of being in traffic and being in their cars and want that connection to their community that walking provides that a car does not. And I think that communities that are investing in this now and have invested in it, and Apex, to be honest, has not really invested in it very much until now. So we have a lot of work to do in that respect. But that's a good investment, I think, to make now because of every age range that finds walking appealing. And also the climate of our area, it's warm and nice 9 months of the year. And so that's another aspect too, is you can build this stuff and they'll use it almost all year long.
I went walking last time I was here in Apex, and last night we went out to eat in Apex and we walked around a little bit. I like the town. I think it's really nice.
Yeah, it's a historic downtown. If your audience is ever in the Raleigh area, come visit. You'll have a great time. The buildings all burned down in the 1910s. There's a big fire, and so everything was built with brick now, and it's lasted until now. So it's a historic downtown, beautiful, and we're actually undertaking a downtown plan right now, master plan exercise, where we're going to try to retain that historic feel of the town, but also making more modern with sidewalks that maybe we'll be expanding, more parks in the area, all these things that we're trying to do to both modernize and keep it nice in the way it is right now, the historic, comfortable feel to the town.
Yeah, I really liked it. Do you have any questions for me?
I guess maybe to you or to your audience. I guess, how do you feel like when you talk about climate change with people who are maybe skeptics? Do you think something like a podcast is a good venue to educate or bring up new ideas?
It's a little bit of a moving target for me. I think since I started doing the podcast, I think it's less likely that people that just don't believe in it and don't want to believe in it are going to be swayed by anything except a personal experience. But I think so many people have had personal experiences, so they know something is going on. They know that climate change is a real thing, and it's not a good thing. It affects them in a bad way. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they understand the specifics because they've only experienced maybe one thing or a section of it. So the podcast brings them stories from many, many people. I also don't think as many people, I wasn't aware of some of the things being done, some of the technologies. I can tell you about some after we're done talking here, or you can listen to my podcast. There are many companies doing very exciting things to try to help, and they're not in the news very often, so people don't know. So I love sharing that with more people. And then the passion that so many people have, and the fact that people are sacrificing and are so excited about helping the mission, it's good for other people to hear about that. So I think that there are people who have told me they didn't know so many technologies were aimed at it, or so many people, or that it was already creating negative changes in the world. So I think those aspects are all really exciting to me, to bring that to other people.
That's great.
Yeah. And how about you? Anything else that I haven't asked you that you want to talk about?
I guess one thing that I am hopeful about is that as municipalities and the county and the state governments up to the federal level, I'm hopeful and think that eventually this issue will be a priority for all levels of government. And right now, I think municipalities are leading the way a lot of times. And private companies like you have on your podcast are leading the way in this. And it's coming up from the ground up. But once you have all these different levels of government, there are economies of scale. There are aspects. We control land use on the municipality, but the roads are often state-built roads. The counties often deal with the human interaction with climate change that will be happening in the future and even happening right now. The federal government, obviously, is the biggest one that provides a lot of the funding and a lot of the power plant regulations, all these things that maybe have the biggest impact on climate change. But I'm hopeful that there's a groundswell of support that I think is starting to build at these lower levels. And I think eventually it's going to get all the way up, and up to the federal level. And when everybody is working together, I think we'll have just so much more impact in all our different realms that we each control than these kind of individual efforts. And so I'm hopeful in the next maybe 2 or 3 or 10 years, when we're really going to need to make some big changes in terms of our society, that all the governments will be aligned in a way that will be the maximum amount of impact.
Right now, we're somewhat rowing in different directions, which cancels a lot of the rowing out.
Yes.
If we were all in the same direction, man, we could move fast.
So, yeah, so as a EPA employee, your audience may know, we had the Clean Power Plan that was signed in 2015, and that has been rescinded, or stayed in the courts and now rescinded, and the plan that's going to be put forward is likely going to be a different kind of plan. But I've learned that the federal government and those kind of things can have a really big impact on climate or CO2 emissions coming from the U.S. And they can provide the leadership to other countries when they want to try to reduce their emissions as well. I hope they'll be able to look to the U.S. as a leader. But in the meantime, when that's not happening, you know, maybe to the urgency that it should be, the local governments and the state governments around North Carolina, and I think a lot of other places, are hopefully having a big impact. But their impact is, you're right, it's limited compared to what the federal, if they're all going at the same time. And so
I'm not saying it's limited as much as it could be so much more. We're saying the same thing.
Right. Definitely. And hopefully, if it's coming up from the bottom up, hopefully the example that municipalities and counties and states are setting will be what everybody uses as an example going forward.
Maybe, I'm just going to throw this out there, maybe the fact that we don't have it coming from the top of the pyramid is bringing the grassroots and the lower levels out with more passion and harder, so when the top does align, we'll be stronger than we could have been if we were only on top at the beginning.
I think that's definitely happening. I mean, we wouldn't need to do this Paris Climate Agreement thing in APEX. Obviously, us doing that resolution is not going to have that big impact on the global scale like the U.S. staying in the thing would, but we probably wouldn't have done that, or the renewable thing, the renewable by 2050, 100% renewable by 2050. That may not have been a policy that we needed to have if that federal government had been kind of going on that same level. Municipalities are often the laboratories of democracy, and so we're experimenting right now, and I think we're doing a great job, and hopefully can provide the great example to other levels of government.
Well, thank you, because I think it's great what you're doing. Is it okay if I wrap this up?
That's good.
And I'm going to wrap it up with a rap.
Okay.
So here we go. You are on the mountaintop, and you noticed a void, and then Hurricane Fran, and then Hurricane Floyd, and you noticed that there was a lot less snow, so you took the solar inspection costs and made it zero. You also talked about when trees grow, the carbon levels go down. Hey, you're a pretty advanced and progressive counselor of Apex Town. You're self-proclaimed nerdy, and you got a hard degree. It was an atmospheric science, and you got a PhD. I was very impressed about all the climate specs. Thank you for welcoming me to Apex.
Bravo! Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Do you always do that?
Greta's looking forward to the day when we have alignment between federal and local governments in the fight against climate change, but realized that without the current differences, APEX would not have endorsed the Paris Climate Accord and potentially would not have passed a resolution for 100% renewable energy. Brett wanted to know if I always rap at the end of my podcasts, and so far, the answer is yes. If you want to see more made-up-on-the-spot improv, and you are in San Diego, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv, or both. To confirm specific dates, or if you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. Brett and the Apex Town Council are working to balance the short-term needs of the town with long-term planning. Not an easy task. But we've run out of time to push carbon reduction to the next generation. And as Brett says, municipalities are often the laboratories of democracy. And by setting an example, they are doing their part to help mitigate climate change.